Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Do you know a student getting ready to go to college? Or are you looking at going back to school yourself? The Woodward Hines Education Foundation and the Get to College program help more Mississippians get to and through college to get certificates and degrees that lead to meaningful employment. They offer free college planning advice, including hands-on FAFSA completion assistance through in-person or virtual appointments. Visit gettocollege.org to learn more.
Good morning. It's 8:30 on Wednesday, March 6th. I'm Desiree Frazier. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, Mississippi House Education Committee advances a bill that would change how the state's public schools are funded. Then women face unique challenges during incarceration, often leading to a cycle of time in and out of prisons. Plus, historians are finding similarities in how white supremacist groups organized in the 60s and today. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. A majority of Mississippi lawmakers want to address how school districts are funded. One bill advancing in the House could make sweeping changes. House Bill 1453, also known as the INSPIRE Act, would replace the Mississippi Adequate Education Program, the current formula. Instead, it would use a baseline dollar amount of about $6,650 per student. Then that amount would get weighted per the needs of the student, the school, and the district by a percentage amount. The House Education Committee voted yesterday to pass the bill for a full House vote. Committee Vice Chair, Republican Representative Kent McCarty of Hattiesburg, speaks with our Will Stribling about the measure.
We talk about budget increases in terms of 3% here, 5% here. In some of these districts, we're talking about 25, 26, 27% increase in 1 year over their FY24 allocation. I mean, that is going to be a game-changing amount of money. If you think about everything you can do with a 25% budget increase for a district that has no local resources, that is going to be a game-changer for those districts, for those students. And we hope, obviously, that that's a game-changer for student outcomes as well.
And there's just a bit about all of the work that went into this and just how gargantuan a task it was to get to this point.
We had a bill a couple years ago that had nothing to do with school funding, but there was a question of it was in regards to students with special needs. We were not able to identify what money we were spending on these students with these severe disabilities. And my thought on that at the time, this was again 2 years ago, was it's insane that we spend such a huge portion of our budget on education. I would say, again, not enough, but we don't know exactly where these dollars are, why these dollars are being allocated, where they're being allocated. So from that point, I had in the back of my mind, if given the opportunity, I want to fix that. I want us to be able to say, if we're talking about a student with a severe learning disability, I want to be able to say, you know, we are investing this amount of money in the education of that child. And so that's where all this began about 2 years ago. And it's been kind of, you know, a work in progress. And then, obviously this is the first term, the first session of a new term. I wasn't sure if I had to come back as vice chairman. I wasn't sure who the chairman would be. I was very fortunate to come back as vice chairman and was happy to see that the speaker was interested in letting us try to work on a piece of legislation to do what we had wanted to do. And in doing so, we also wanted to address the inequitable allocation problem that MAP has. I want to be clear, I'm not at all saying that I think MAP is a bad formula. I think MAP was a good formula, and I think MAP has done what it needed to do. This is just a much more fair way to allocate the money. And I think that is such a big story there. And we spent a lot of time talking about the front end of the bill, how we get the number, how the number grows over time. All these things are important. And I'm glad that we've addressed that with the inflation changes. I'm glad we've got the independent committee from MDE to give us a recommendation every 4 years. But I'm more happy than anything that at the end of all of that, we've got a formula that is finally sending, if it passes and becomes law, we've got a formula that's finally sending money to the districts that need it the most. And I just think that is such a victory for the districts in Mississippi that are so badly hurting for more resources.
And as you mentioned, there are a few number of districts that are getting less money under this formula, but they are wealthier ones with larger tax bases. Can you just talk a bit about that, how even the quote-unquote losers in this scenario aren't losing much?
Right. So because we're investing so much new money into education, even those who would have, if we had level funded this, would have lost a substantial amount of money, they're still coming out about where they were before. In addition to that, we've got a hold harmless provision in place for 3 years so that in year one, there won't be any cut to any district across the state. Every district will, at a minimum, receive the same amount of money they received last year. In year two, they could see as much as a 3% reduction, and then in year three, they could see as much as an additional 3% reduction. So that gives these districts that are losing, even if they're just losing a little bit, kind of an off-ramp to plan and figure out. And the other side of that is that even though those districts are not getting more money under this formula, they're still in high growth districts with a very rich property base that could easily see their property base grow enough to make up that difference after the first year, so that they really in reality probably won't ever see less funding than they see now just because of the organic growth that their districts are seeing.
That's House Republican Kent McCarty of Hattiesburg. It's currently estimated that Inspire Act could cost nearly $3 billion, but supporters say those costs could be distributed more equally to school districts. And one way of doing that is by weighting percentages. They would be added for schools with many low-income students, for example. Also, on the House Education Committee is Republican Jensen Owens of Poplarville. He says this formula will accommodate factors the MAEP formula hasn't been able to do.
You know, the biggest change is the inflation, the annual inflation adjustment that we put in the statute automatically. So we basically took what the Senate has in their plan, 20% of the 20% of the base student costs multiplied by the CPI, annual CPI, and that's the automatic adjustment every year once the 3-year hold harmless period expires. And then from there, we also made some significant changes to the advisory council, and we made sure that we have 8 superintendents, non-political appointees who are participating in that advisory council to give us our base student cost recommendation every 4 years.
With these, these extra weights, what impact do you expect this to have on districts that have not gotten equitable funding under MAEP all these years?
Well, they're going to get equitable funding. If you look at there's a graph that I'd be glad to send out. You look as it goes across to the right, the less money a district has, as far as ad valorem is concerned, the more money they're getting from the state. And then if you look at the sheet here, you can see our poorer districts are getting massive increases and are getting they're being treated well as compared to some of our wealthier districts.
And then now that y'all have got this across this hurdle, what does it look like going forward in trying to reconcile y'all's plan and the Senate's plan?
I'm extremely confident we're going to pass it out of the House with bipartisan support, and hopefully that'll send a message to the Senate that this is well received over here and a good plan for our students.
Lawmakers haven't fully funded the current education formula in years, over 20. Coming up, women face unique challenges during incarceration, often leading to a cycle of time in and out of prisons. That's according to a new report. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Mississippi Antique Showcase is coming to Natchez, Mississippi, Friday, May 3rd and Saturday, May 4th. We'll have professional appraisers on site evaluating antiques, furniture, and treasured keepsakes. For a one-time gift of $100, you'll receive one ticket, complimentary food, cocktails, and a single item appraisal. Call 1-844-874-6874 or go to mpbonline.org to reserve your spot now.
Hi, I'm Richard Gershon, the host of In Legal Terms and a professor at the University of Mississippi School of Law. If you miss a live In Legal Terms episode, find our podcast, inlegalterms.mpbonline.org.
MPB Think Radio, whatever your taste, news, music, storytelling, or how-to shows, whatever your city, Gulfport, Hernando, Meridian, Greenville, however you want, radio, smart speaker, smartphone app, MPB Think Radio.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. A new report finds women in Mississippi prisons face unique challenges behind bars, making it easier for them to slip into a cycle of being released only to quickly return to prison. That's according to the Prison Policy Initiative, a nonprofit, nonpartisan group. Mississippi has the highest incarceration rate per capita in the U.S. Nearly 30,000 are women. Mike Wessler is with the Prison Policy Initiative. He tells our Mike McEwen women are often taking a back seat in the conversations about prison reform and ways to reduce recidivism.
To some extent, it's a little bit understandable. Women certainly make a smaller portion of the population of people who are incarcerated in this country. You know, roughly 10% of people who are incarcerated are women. So it's a smaller portion. But the carceral system is particularly harsh for women for a number of different reasons. So them falling through the cracks can often kind of leave them struggling and floundering with some of the most difficult issues. And getting data about the incarceration of women is particularly hard because many of the agencies that produce data about prisons and jails don't really look into the experiences of women. So we tried to plug that gap with this report by kind of taking a big picture look at where women are incarcerated, why they're incarcerated, and a little bit about their experiences, both behind bars and pre-incarceration as well. And our hope is that it'll help policymakers develop solutions that will ultimately keep women out of prison and jail in the first place, and by instituting programs and policies that address some of the underlying challenges that result in women ending up behind bars. Many of those are related to things like poverty and mental health issues, untreated substance use disorder, and of course, any discussion about mass incarceration obviously has to also include a discussion about the policing of Black women.
An introductory line in the press release for the report says that women in the U.S. experience a dramatically different criminal legal system than men do. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think the biggest difference between men's incarceration and women's incarceration is the role of local jails. You know, men, when they're incarcerated, are much more likely to end up in prison rather than a local jail, whereas women end up in their local jails. And there are a number of different reasons for this. A lot of it's because women are more likely to be charged with property or drug crimes or public order crimes, things that will result in them being incarcerated for less than a year, which usually in those circumstances they stay in jails, or they'll be incarcerated just for an even shorter period beyond that, so they'll be in the jails. So jails play a larger role for women than they do for men when it comes to incarceration. Now, I want to note that in this report, we noted that on any given day, 84,000 women are in local jails across the country. Now, that number is a snapshot at a given time on any given day. Ultimately, about 2 million women go through the doors of jails every single year. In Mississippi, 29,000 women go through the doors of jails every single year. That's roughly the size of a legislative district in Mississippi, that of women who are kind of cycling through the jails of the state. Many of those are women who will return multiple times because their addiction issues, their poverty issues, their untreated mental health issues don't get resolved. And, you know, there's often folks who will say that sometimes a stint behind bars can do somebody struggling with substance use disorder good. It'll help to get them clean, they say. But the facts simply don't line up with that. Jails in particular are poorly equipped to meet the needs of somebody struggling with substance use disorder. Most jails don't provide, or they provide very little, if any, treatment options for substance use disorder. In particular, they are unlikely to provide medication-assisted treatment, which is the gold standard for treatment of opioid use disorder. So women who end up behind bars because of substance use disorders are unlikely to get any help there. They're unlikely to actually tackle their substance use challenges. So jails are simply a place to lock them up, and then they're released without any actual help of the challenges or with the challenges that they're facing. And another reason that jails are particularly damaging for women is women are much more likely to be primary caregivers for their children. And even a short jail stint, just a few nights, can be incredibly disruptive to their custody and their living situation. Children can be ripped from their homes if their mother is incarcerated for even a day or two at a time. So it can have really destabilizing effects for women. They can lose their jobs. Jails are often overlooked in conversations about mass incarceration, but when it comes to women, they are one of the key issues that people really need to talk about.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could speak about some of the ripple effects, especially socially and maybe even health-related, relating to women and mass incarceration.
When somebody's incarcerated, whether it's for a single night or for a year, it'll have incredible collateral consequences on their lives. One, it'll put their housing at risk. They're often working low-wage jobs where taking time off on a planned basis is difficult. Taking it off on an unplanned basis when you're incarcerated is nearly impossible. So many of these women will lose their jobs once they're incarcerated, even if it's for a night or just a night or two in a jail. And that'll kind of set off a destabilizing string of events that can often result in them losing their housing. It can result in them returning to abusive situations that they may have tried to flee from. And like I said before, it can result in them losing their children. Now, on the health front, jails, as I mentioned, are particularly poorly equipped to meet the medical needs of women. And one of the main reasons for that is jails are built for short-term stays. Prisons have better health care facilities. I want to be clear, prison health care facilities are not good. Jail health care facilities are even worse. And when women spend the majority of their time incarcerated in a jail, they're not likely to be able to tap into mental health care that they might need. They're unlikely to be able to tap into substance use treatment that they might need.
Mike Wessler is with the Prison Policy Initiative in Massachusetts. Coming up, historians are finding similarities in how white supremacist organizations got together in the 60s to do what they do and modern day. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Find out what home repair projects you can accomplish on Fix-It 101 at 9. At 10, get help with solving technology problems on Everyday Tech. Then get your general health questions answered on the original Southern Remedy at 11. You can subscribe to the podcast of your favorite locally produced program on any podcasting app. After airing, all locally produced MPB Think Radio programs are available as podcasts. Subscribe using any podcasting app. From children's education to gripping drama, documentaries to comedy, MPB Television brings the world to Mississippi. With local stories, cooking, health, and music, MPB Television takes Mississippi to the world.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. When James Meredith enrolled at the University of Mississippi in 1962, a mob of segregationists led by Major General Edwin Walker started a riot. And historians say they are seeing similarities in how those hate groups are spreading then and now. Peter Adams is author of the new book, The Insurrectionist, Major General Edwin A. Walker, and the Birth of the Deep State Conspiracy. He's also this week's speaker at History is Lunch today at noon at the two Mississippi Museums in Jackson. Adams tells our Kobe Vance, Major General Edwin Walker was charged with insurrection for his actions in Oxford.
Which is the same U.S. code that the Capitol rioters of January 6, 2021 were charged. And so in a lot of ways, Walker, who was an unrepentant segregationist and a perpetrator of bizarre conspiracy theories in the early 1960s, we can see ominous parallels to our current political situation and current political problems.
So what got you interested in this topic?
Well, oddly enough, Walker died in 1993. And I happened to read his obituary in the New York Times, and I thought to myself, this is an unusual individual. And he might make an interesting biography. Two other interesting things about Walker is that although he led the riot against the admission of James Meredith to the University of Mississippi, He was the man who led the troops to protect the Little Rock Nine in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. So, you know, there's some very interesting odd twists in his career. He was a two-star general, and he obeyed the orders from the commander-in-chief at that time, President Eisenhower, although he said that he would remain a white supremacist. The other unusual part about Walker's career is that 6 months before Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated President Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald attempted to assassinate General Edwin A. Walker. So Walker is seen throughout the Warren Commission report, and he has a very interesting series of events around his life. He was also arrested in 1976 and 1977 for approaching a male vice officer in a Dallas Park restroom. So he was also a very deeply closeted gay man, which, of course, in the circles that he traveled, including the Ku Klux Klan and the militia movement, the Minutemen, this would have been a serious problem for him.
With the growing public consciousness about different white supremacy groups and groups that I guess General Walker probably would have associated with if he were still around, I wanted to get your thoughts on seeing the, I guess, parallels between what your research showed and then what you've been seeing now.
Yeah, there are really, really strange and troubling parallels between Walker's career in the early 1960s and the rise of far-right extremist groups in the early 1960s and what we have today. As a matter of fact, in 1961, journalist Alan Barth predicted that Walker's radical followers would seek to capture control of the Republican Party. But Barth held out hope that genuine conservatives would, quote, not forsake the traditions of their party for a forlorn kind of fascism. So you can see, even back in the early 1960s, there was concern that some of these very dangerous elements within the far right had the interest and possibly even the capability of capturing control of a major political party, in this case, the Republican Party. And so we see that today, obviously, with the rise of very dangerous extremism inside the Republican Party.
What put Walker in the position to be at Ole Miss and instigating the riots that were around the integration of the school?
Well, even as the case of James Meredith was working its way through the court system to get him registered, Walker immediately came to the side of Governor Ross Barnett. And he urged his followers, of which Walker believed there were thousands of his followers, which wasn't really true, but he urged his followers to converge on the university campus. And of course, by September 29th of 1962, and September 30th, when the actual riot started to occur, he was leading the charge against federal marshals that had surrounded the Lyceum. And hundreds of people converged on the campus with the intent of trying to prevent James Meredith from actually going to the registrar's office. And Attorney General Robert Kennedy and the president himself certainly were concerned that Walker would create the mayhem that actually occurred, in which two people were killed on the campus, as many of us know, and the campus was left smoldering for several days. It took really Federalized National Guard and the U.S. Army, the 101st Airborne, to restore order to the campus. And finally, of course, Walker himself was arrested and booked at the federal building.
Peter Adams is author of the new book, The Insurrectionist, Major General Edwin A. Walker and the Birth of the Deep State Conspiracy. He's speaking at Today's History is Lunch at the two Mississippi Museums in Jackson. This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.